listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. It is really a great honor to open our fall Aloud season with tonight's guests, Stephen Gerald Breyer, Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court. He's one of the court's great thinkers and a leading legal voice of our time, and we have welcomed many great thinkers to the Los Angeles Public Library, and this is our first United States Supreme Court Justice, and you are here to see it, so it's a great night. Tonight's program is in a conversation format, as it so often is at Aloud, and we're very fortunate to have Henry Weinstein as our interlocutor. Henry was a staff writer at the LA Times from 1978 to 2008, specializing in the coverage of law and labor, and he was one of the Times' most respected journalists and won numerous journalistic awards, including, in 2006, the John Chancellor Award for Excellence, which recognizes a body of work marked by courage, integrity, curiosity, and intelligence. Henry is a member of the California Bar, and he currently teaches law and journalism at UC Irvine School of Law. Justice Stephen Breyer's roots are in California. He attended the esteemed Lowell High School. Any Lowell High School graduates here? I think there are a few. In San Francisco, where he participated actively in the debate team and incidentally competed future California Governor Jerry Brown. He attended Stanford and won a Marshall Scholarship to attend Oxford. He studied law at Harvard, where he distinguished himself as an editor of the Law Review. Justice Arthur Goldberg selected Breyer as his clerk for the 1964-65 term of the Supreme Court, and after he completed his clerkship at the Supreme Court, he worked in the Justice Department's Antitrust Division, taught at Harvard University Kennedy School of Government, and served as assistant special prosecutor in the Watergate investigation before being appointed to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit in 1980. He became its chief judge in 1990. President Clinton nominated him as an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, and he took his seat August 3, 1994, becoming the 108th Supreme Court Justice. His previous book, Active Liberty, about the role of the Supreme Court in American life, was lauded by reviewers as deserving a place of honor in national debates, now and in the future. And he amplifies his views on the court in his groundbreaking new book, Making Our Democracy Work, A Judge's View, in which he discusses what the court must do to maintain public confidence, your confidence. After Henry Weinstein's conversation with Justice Breyer, we're going to open up to questions from you, and we ask that you wait until the microphone comes to you as we do record for podcast. And remember, Making Democracy Work is the subtitle of tonight's program, so please make your questions, and we'll all listen to each other and try and get as many questions in as we can. And after the program, we'll take a brief break. We're going to redress the stage with a table so that we can do the book signing here on the stage. If you want to have a book signed, you'll want to line up here, and the books will be for sale in the lobby, courtesy of the library store. Signature only tonight, but you will be able to have your book signed here. Please turn off your cell phones and pagers. I look forward to hearing your questions, and I know you will be asking some good ones. Now please join me in welcoming Henry Weinstein and the Honorable Stephen J. Breyer, Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court, to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Good evening. First thing I'd like to do, Justice Breyer, is to thank you for writing a fine book. I want to just hold this up so everybody can get a look at it, called Making Our Democracy Work, A Judge's View. It's a thoughtful book about the Constitution, some key aspects of Supreme Court history, and your thoughts on the proper role of a justice. The first thing I wanted to ask you was, this is the second time in 5 years that you've written a book that's about the court, about the role of the court in the country, and you're espousing, you know, some of your own judicial philosophy. And near the end of the book, you say that without public understanding of how government works, and then I quote, the judiciary can't independently enforce our Constitution's liberty-protecting limits, unquote. Do you think that the public has an insufficient understanding of the role of the Supreme Court in this country?
First, I want to thank you for inviting me here. I'm fabulous. Second, I thought that was a pretty good question. You know what I thought he was leading up to? He said, the second time in 5 years you've written a book, don't you have anything else to do? And the answer to the question you did ask is yes, I do think people have an insufficient understanding. And don't just talk to me, talk to Sandra O'Connor or David Souter or any of us. What worries us is what we used to have. Maybe you have that in this library. Maybe that's the substitute. We used to have something called 12th grade civics. And what we get on a bus and we'd go stop at, what was that place called? The Nut Tree Inn, I think, or something. We'd go on, up to to Sacramento. And we'd go look at the governor's office, and we'd listen to the legislature, and we'd come back, and we had Youth in Government Day or something, and you'd take positions in the government, and you really learned quite a lot about government. Now, that still exists in a lot of places, but in some it doesn't. And this is a cause for concern. It's a cause for me, because it's part of my professional concern. If people can't understand how the institutions work, how are they going to run them? And the whole point of the document, after all, is the people who decide what kinds of cities, towns, states, nations to have. It's called us. I mean, it's us and our role as citizens. And you can't do it if you don't know how what's going on. So, of course, I'm concerned. Absolutely. And so you say, well, I thought you've written a book. Huh? A few will read it. And will it make a difference? Perhaps not. But I do think, and giving my job, as we all have jobs, and we all are citizens, and you say, well, we'll do our best on this. That's why you're in the library committee. Okay. We don't know if we can make a difference, but we'll try.
But you haven't just written a book. You've now written two books, I mean, in addition to the books you wrote when you were a law professor. And you've got a tour for this book where you've already been interviewed by George Stephanopoulos, Nina Totenberg, Terry Gross. You're moving on to San Francisco tomorrow night. Some people used to think that the Supreme Court was kind of a cloistered monastery. You'd never see these people. You would only see their words or they would appear in court. Has something changed? I mean, you debated Justice Scalia on television about, whether you should pay attention to foreign courts. I know Scalia does a fair amount of speaking. Justice Thomas does. I mean, has something changed in the chemistry of the court? I think people think you folks are getting a bit more accessible.
Yes. And I think it's interesting what's changed. First, you could say my five-day tour of the glitzy television world is probably reflective of my seven-year-old desire to listen to the radio programs coming out of this city, where Jack Benny used to say, and he's a star of stage, screen, and radio. Gee, that sounds great. And so I have 4 days of experience with that. It's okay. And to a point, until you say something that's embarrassing, and then you're a little sorry about the whole thing. That's a more personal aspect. The fact is that I think on our court, we all realize we have a certain problem with communication. And it's a problem that many of us have. Those who are significantly younger than us get their information by looking. A lot of it. And however many libraries you have, there's still going to be a lot of people who will look at the screen. And our dilemma, which is the dilemma that I've tried to reflect very much, is this. When I say "our," I'm not personalizing it. I mean the institution. Hamilton was the one who said there should be a Supreme Court with the power to set aside laws of Congress that are unconstitutional. Why? Well, he said it's not a good idea to have a document, say, like this one, short, sets boundaries, doesn't tell people what to do, really. It just sets outer boundaries. But if somebody can't enforce it, nobody's going to pay any attention to it. Might as well hang it up in the wall in the museum. So who should be the people that have the last word about what it means in an enforcement sense? He says, if it's the president, too powerful, already too powerful. He'll let himself do anything. Well, what about Congress? They're elected. He says, that's the problem. He says, that's the problem. Because a lot of the words in this document are meant to protect people who are unpopular at times when it's unpopular to protect them. And Congress is great on what's popular. It wouldn't be in their jobs if they weren't. But do you think they'll really be able to say this law we just passed because it's popular violates the Constitution, so we won't do it? He said, if you think they're going to do that very often, you are in a dream world. I'm paraphrasing what he said. So he said, well, you see, there is still one group left. There are these sort of bureaucratic types up there in the court, judges. And they're weak. They don't have the power of the purse, and they don't have the power of the sword. And they're fairly professional, and they won't cause too much trouble. Let's give them the job. All right? Now, the question he didn't ask, which I think he might have, I don't know how he would have answered it, is this: if these people are so weak, if they have no army, if they have no money, and if nobody's ever heard of them, why in heaven's name will anybody do what they say, particularly when it's unpopular? It's Hotspur's question. I love this. In Henry IV, Owen Glendower, you know, comes in. He's a Welsh mystic, isn't he? I mean, all these Welsh are mystics. That's his idea. And so he says to Hotspur, he says, I can summon spirits from the vasty deep. And Hotspur says, so can I. So can any man. But when you call them, will they come? That's the question. And maybe Hamilton didn't ask it, but history did. History did. So you can go through this. Now, it's a long question, but I'm getting there. And the point is, if we want this institution to survive, you have to convince the general public that it is worth having an institution that will, in order to protect the document, make a lot of decisions they don't like. And sometimes they'll even be wrong, as I've sometimes thought, in dissent. Now, that's not such an easy thing to ask of people. And they're never going to do it if they don't understand the institution and they don't understand the government. You didn't think I was going to answer your question, but I did.
Well, speaking of the document that you're holding in your hand, you cover many subjects in this book, but one of the subjects that you cover is your approach to being a justice. And I think it's fair to say that there are, I'm not going to quantify this, but there are some significant portions of this book that are what I would call a pretty much a frontal attack on originalism. And originalism, as I think many in the audience know, is the philosophy that's primarily espoused by one of your colleagues, Justice Antonin Scalia. And basically his position is that that document is what it was the day that it was printed and that it's fixed forever. I've got a couple of questions that I wanted to ask you about that. You clearly have a different approach. You believe that the document's alive. And I guess I'd like to know how you, tell the people here your approach to the Constitution and how it ought to be evaluated in particular situations and why you think it's a better approach than originalism.
Well, I have two real targets in the book. One target is the view that it's just God-given that we'll always follow whatever the Supreme Court says. And I want to see how people understand the history of that and how difficult that is to have achieved and why it's never certain and why people always have to be alert and why there's plus and minus when in fact there are decisions made that you really disagree with. And you have to really be looking out there to say, nonetheless, in general, this institution's worthwhile. I want to show the fragility of that. That's one target. Now, my other target is not really originalism. My target in the other part is what all of you at some level will absolutely think. What the Supreme Court bases its decisions on is politics. It's junior varsity political. And if you ask most Americans, that's what they'll think. And I want to say that isn't right. Or I can't say it's not 100% wrong because it's just grossly distorted. And I want them to understand what it is through my eyes. Even if I'm wrong, I still can tell you what it looks like through my eyes. I'm not wrong about that. And I want to say, look, people think it's politics. Well, hey, if it's politics, why wasn't this job given to Congress? They're so much better at it. Boy, and if you think in the history of the court, try Dred Scott. I mean, a terrible decision. A decision that condemned all people who were descended from slaves to a kind of limbo where they could never be citizens. And they said it in the worst possible way. I won't even repeat it. Terrible decision. But the most you can say for that, I think, is that Roger Taney, who was the Chief Justice then, had a political objective. Stop a civil war. Okay, I'll give him the benefit of that doubt. And I'll say, Chief Justice, if your objective was political, what history shows is you were a terrible politician. Because the dissent in that case, written by Benjamin Curtis of Massachusetts, who was a moderate, tears him limb from limb in a polite way, but destroys that majority. And it led Abraham Lincoln to say, this is a legal astonisher, Dred Scott, and to use Curtis's decision when he wrote his famous Cooper Union speech, which made him a viable national candidate, which put the Republican Party with him at its head on the road to electoral victory and meant the end of slavery at the cost of a civil war. So if that was Taney's objective to stop that, he sure didn't. Now, do you see? Long answer, but we're not politicians, and forget that. Now, well, then you say, okay, you must be sitting there doing whatever thing you think is good. I say, I never get to say what I think is good. And not just because of dissent, because it's much more complicated than that. Oh, now originalism. Well, if you think we must be doing politics or we must be doing whatever we think is good, then you're in a perfect position for someone else to come along and say there's only one way to have straightforward judges who aren't subjective. We've got to have a criteria that's strict. We've got to have something that's rigid, strict, and definite. And that's history. So you look back to see what Madison and Hamilton thought in detail, what everybody thought at that time, and whatever they thought at that time, that's it. So I have to admit, I do attack that view. I do think that view is wrong for a number of different reasons. And then you say, well, what do I substitute? Pretty complicated. I substitute something that first sounds like a 4th of July speech, that this document has in it values that are permanent, and we can find out what they are, like free speech, like a degree of privacy when you talk about the Fourth Amendment, unreasonable search and seizures, like free religion, people teaching their own religion to their children and practicing it themselves. Pretty high level of generality. I say, but our job really is to take those pretty general principles, which don't change, and to try to apply them to circumstances that change dramatically over time. And you'll see something in that. You say the Commerce Clause, they didn't know about cars, trucks, television. First Amendment, they never heard of the internet. And we've got to figure out how to apply the values then to now. But you like that, it sounds okay, or at least to some people. And then you'll say, but really, that's just a 4th of July speech. So what I'm trying to do is say, no, it isn't. No, it isn't. I can show you in enough depth, that you'll begin to see what the approach is. And that's the best I can do. See, it's a problem for a judge. Judges, appellate judges, we write cases. We write opinions. They're pretty long. And by the time you read them, you are asleep. And I mean, it's true. And I have dozens of them. Read them. I mean, I was like the woman who sent Her husband sends her to the psychiatrist. She says, my husband sent me to see you, the psychiatrist. Why? Because I like pancakes. What's wrong with that? I like them myself. Great, I have 12 trunks full. Okay, I mean, I have all those opinions, you know. I mean, you can read them, but people won't, and they shouldn't necessarily. So I want to try here to give enough in different areas of what the approaches are so that you'll begin to think it isn't just a 4th of July speech. It is a set of approaches that can take values that don't change, that can work out cooperative relationships with other parts of the government and produce law that works a little bit better. That's the object. And it's not just to say originalism doesn't work, which in my opinion, it doesn't work one little bit. I'll change that. I don't want to be mean. Doesn't work one bit. Okay. But it is to show a different approach. And I think it's an approach that I didn't make up. I found in Gordon Wood's book. Perfect. He talks about the history of the United States just before 1800. And he's talking about the judiciary, too. And I found a pretty good quote there from a judge in Connecticut, Jesse Root. He said, "The American tradition, the American tradition of judging at the appellate level, of working with law, he describes as prudent and pragmatic." And I said, that's pretty good. That describes judges whom I admire in the past, Learned Hand, Holmes, Brandeis, Cardoza. I said, okay. And now, can I work with those words? Can I work with that idea? Can I work with the tradition that's a very old tradition in this country and try to do something that isn't computer capable? Computers can't make the decisions that judges make. I think so. I don't necessarily get it right, but I think so. And that's what I've tried to explain.
So you excoriate, quite understandably, the Dred Scott decision.
I just said I didn't excoriate. No. I just said people generally feel it's the worst one ever made.
But I was going to. You were saying earlier, you know, that Hamilton and some others said, "Oh well, let's let these guys have the last word." But there have been some situations, in a way, as you know, in a way, you didn't have the court didn't have the last word because people decided to defy the court, and you have a very interesting section of your book, very important section of the book, about what happened in the aftermath of probably, I think, the greatest decision of my lifetime, Brown versus Board of Education, and which was defied in the South. And I think you ought to talk a little bit about what happened then and what happened down in Little Rock 3 years later when the governor and angry mob said they weren't going to let people go to school.
Pretty interesting. I want to start here with the Cherokee Indian case in the 30s because the Cherokee Indians were given a certain amount of land in northern Georgia, and the Supreme Court said, it's yours. The Georgians wanted it. After all, there was gold found there. And their view was, why should the Indians have the gold? We should have it. Interesting view. But the law was to the contrary, and the court said that, and that was a case you may have heard of because Andrew Jackson supposedly said about the court's decision, John Marshall, the Chief Justice, has made his decision, now let him enforce it. And he sent troops, and the troops went to the Cherokee territory, but not to enforce the law, but to evict the Indians. And they were evicted. And they traveled the Trail of Tears, called that because many died, to Oklahoma, where their descendants still live. That was 1830. Now, you know, you roll the clock forward, and you get the Civil War. That wasn't judges fighting, it was everybody. And then we have 80 years about segregation. And now the court says, no more segregation. That's out. Just look here. See what it says? It says, no person shall be deprived, no state shall deprive no person of equal protection of the law. You think it's equal protection of the law to have black schools, white schools, segregation according to law? Open your eyes and look. You know, there was no one who could open his eyes and look who wouldn't have seen what was going on. The court says, I think we should recognize what's going on. Out. Done. Finished. Wonderful. Great victory. Except thereafter, what happened? Nothing. Very, very little. Let me not exaggerate. But Eisenhower did desegregate the District of Columbia. But not much else. All right. Now, that's why I say rolling the clock forward, the time that I stop it and want to look at what's happening was that instance in Little Rock. And some of us can remember that with Governor Faubus under a court decree to integrate Central High School said no. And he says, I have the militia. Try it. I have the state troopers. And he had a long discussion with Eisenhower at the request of the mayor of Little Rock and Brooks Hayes, who was the congressman then. He went up to Newport, where Eisenhower was spending the summer. And he said, the president dressed me down like a general dresses a sergeant. Okay. He told Eisenhower he'd behave and walked out and told the news the contrary. And went down there and did nothing. And pictures went around the world. Everyone saw the picture of that black student, the woman who wanted to get into that school, and the woman behind her, white, her face was contorted with rage. And what was in front of them was a mob. Well, Eisenhower sent the 101st Airborne. And that was a pretty brave decision of him, because he'd been told by Jimmy Burns, who some of you remember was the governor of South Carolina and was a great friend of Harry Truman and did a lot for the country during the war and had been on the Supreme Court of the United States, but he left to run the war mobilization, economic effort. And he said to Eisenhower, what will happen if you send troops is you will have to reoccupy the South and you will have a second Reconstruction. And if you think you can do that, go right ahead. And he said, the best that's going to happen is that the schools will all be closed, and then nobody will be educated. And that's what he was told. And Eisenhower said, I'm going to do it, and he did it. And he went on the radio and said, this is it. And he picked the 101st Airborne purposely. The 101st Airborne people knew who they were, and some of us know. They were the heroes of World War II who'd been there on D-Day and been dropped in, and a lot of them, we had the pictures. They'd been hung up on the steeples. They dropped some of them the wrong place. They were there in little towns, and they just got shot down. And they were heroes at the Battle of the Bulge. There was no division that was more heroic in the public mind. And 1,000 of them were put on airplanes and sent to Little Rock. And the next morning, they got out and took those black children and walked with them into that white school. It was a great day for the law as well in the United States. And the pictures went around the world. And I'd like to say, okay, it all had a happy ending, but it didn't have that happy an ending. The court heard the case later when Little Rock wanted to stop and not do it anymore, and they said, no, do it, and they all signed the opinion, all nine, and they had a hard time writing this opinion. They had minor disagreements about this or that. But they wrote it, and they said, all nine of us will say, but you could have said nine judges, you could have 900 judges, you could have 9,000 judges. Where are those troops? And they closed the school next day. School was closed for a year, and read what happened to those kids. And interesting enough, that woman who made faces of horror at Elizabeth Eckford, who was one of the Little Rock Nine who went in there very bravely, she and Elizabeth spent their last part of their lives, or recently, touring the country and talking about repentance. Good for them. But I'm just saying there were a lot of ups and downs in this. But the country was on the right track. It was on the right track. And I tell this story, and why I like that story, is the State Department sent over to the court a Russian paratroop general, and he had been in charge of missiles. And they'd all been pointed at the United States, and he'd pointed them the other way, and the State Department felt that was a good thing. And we should be nice to this man. And so they sent him over to the court. So he said, what is your favorite case? I said, this is one, this case of Little Rock and Cooper versus Aaron. I said, what it shows the paratroopers and the judges must be friends. I want them to know this story. I want people to know this story. I want them to see the fragility of it. I want them to see the uncertainty. I want them to see the difficulty of having a country where, in fact, people will follow the law. It's so easy to do when you agree with it. And there we are. You see the point. And that's why I'm telling the story.
So let's bring that story a little further forward. You were saying a few moments ago that you don't get to just say what's good, but sometimes you do say what's bad. And 3 years ago, there was a case that some people think eroded the Brown decision, a case called, parents from Seattle and Louisville challenged some voluntary desegregation programs, and you dissented in those cases. I think it'd be safe to say that you were pretty angry about those cases. I want to read a couple of passages from your dissenting opinion. You said that the prevailing opinion, written by Chief Justice Roberts, quote, risks serious injury to the law and for the nation. You said the court decision slows down and sets back the work of local school boards to bring about racially diverse schools. And in conclusion, you said, quote, the last half century has witnessed great strides toward racial equality, but we have not realized the promise of Brown. To invalidate the plans under review is to threaten the promise of Brown, unquote. And on the day that opinion was released, you delivered part of your dissent from the bench, and you added something that was not in the text of your written opinion, and you said, it is not often in the law that so few have so quickly changed so much. Could you tell us a little bit about what you meant in that phrase, and also what's your assessment of how the court is operating now?
Well, I think from the parts you picked out, one might conclude that I felt fairly strongly that the majority was wrong. I did. I thought they were wrong. I mean, I think I was reasonably polite. I didn't have a temper tantrum. I had a calm manner, and I wrote a long opinion. And that's what you can do when you're a judge. If you think somebody's seriously wrong, that's a kind of torture for a lot of people, but you can write a long opinion, and you can explain why. And so I explained in as much depth and detail as I could muster, organizing it, spending a long period of time thinking about it, why it was that I thought the Constitution permitted. And this is a controversial subject. Permitted a school board or a town or a city to take account of race when used affirmatively to include people, to help create a society that includes everyone. But it's a different matter when it uses race to exclude people. I'm not advocating that former as a matter of policy. In that opinion, I say, I think it's up to the local town or school board or whatever commission to decide whether they think what program of what type will, in fact, be helpful. In the two cities under consideration, the city of Seattle had worked long and hard to figure out a way that made very little use of race, but simply wanted to assure white families that had gone to the suburbs that if they came back, they'd have a wide range of choice of what high schools to go to. And if they didn't get their first choice, because we want to maintain some degree, and it was a limited degree, of racial balance, next year you can go to the one of your choice. So there was some use of race. And Louisville, over time, which had started with a system of segregated schools, had gotten over that, had left court supervision, and had a system that did use racial balance to some degree, quotas, if you like, but it wasn't quite quotas. It was a complicated system. But they wanted to assure that schools wouldn't become all white or all black. Now, in that community, those plans had worked fairly well, according to the people who'd lived with them. And the question for us was whether we would say that the Constitution prohibited those communities from doing that. And so I went into all the things in depth, and I went into the prior precedent, and I went into all of the law that had been previously set down, and I can, in my own view, in the view of three others, the prior law, the prior precedent, the prior principles demanded a different result. It gave the freedom to those communities to have those kinds of plans if they wanted. Now, there were two views of that. five people held one and four held the other. And some people do think. It's not as an idiotic argument either. The Constitution has to be absolutely colorblind. Okay? And others think there is a difference between trying to bring people in and keeping them out. And we think, I'm in on that side of it, we think that those who wrote this amendment were trying to create for people who had previously been slaves, or whose parents had been, a country where everyone was included. And that isn't such a hard or easy thing to bring about. Okay, I'm giving you a flavor of the argument. When I do that, it sounds as if I'm trying to re-argue my point. And that's what he's provoked me into doing. But well, I guess the point is I can't prove I'm right. And I can just show you on the court people have different views. And when I feel very strongly about something, which happens occasionally, what I'll do is write this long opinion and subject you all to this long explanation. And sometimes larded there within it are a few phrases that he can pick out and say, I've excoriated them, which it didn't feel quite like that at the time, though I did recognize that I was having the judicial equivalent of a temper tantrum.
Yes, well, when I reread it, it certainly felt like excoriation, I can assure you. Last year, the president created, a little bit of a dust-up in some quarters when he talked about empathy being something that he thought would potentially a good value for a justice. Does empathy have any role in the work of a Supreme Court justice?
I don't know what word to use, but I can say this, and some here are in an appellate bench, and I think the appellate bench feels this the most. I mean, what is the job of an appellate judge, whether it's in the Supreme Court or whether it's in the Court of Appeals? It's really reading opinions. I explained this to Michael, who I had as a library commissioner in San Francisco. I'm going to tell about it. But in any case, when he was young, going to high school, I said, if you do your homework well, you'll get a job. You can do homework the whole rest of your life. I said, well, the job of an appellate judge is you're reading and you're writing. You're reading briefs, and you turn around, there's the word processor, and you're writing. And the law clerks help with memos and so forth, but ultimately you sit there and write. And those words matter, because they matter either to the people in front of you or the people in that community or sometimes even beyond. And so the object is to write an opinion that will have an impact, often in areas of the law that are very unclear, very unclear. And my personal view, and the view of many appellate judges, is that when you go into that room at age 52 or 53 or 54 or whatever, you better have enough imagination and experience to know what the lives of other people are likely to be like, because what you are going to do is going to affect them. So the more that you are aware of how others live, the more that you are aware of how your decisions will or could affect their lives, the better a judge you'll be. And I call that, because my wife is English, and the word that she uses to describe that is imagination. But it's imagination in a special sense. It's imagining how other people think and act and behave and what kind of lives they have. And that is not an easy thing to do, and nobody's terrific at it. But you can try. And if you're trying to get at that point, fine.
So perhaps the most wrenching, at least, case that came in front of the court since you've been there, at least arguably, was the case called Bush versus Gore.
That was stressful.
Yes. And that's, I think we. And you're a. When your first book came out several years ago, I mean your book Act of Liberty, there was a story written in, I believe it was in the New Yorker, that said that in the aftermath of Bush versus Gore, that you had spent a certain amount of time trying to buck up some of your law clerks because they were demoralized about the process. And I don't know if that's true. I was going to ask you about that in a minute, but I wanted to ask you something about that case and about and its aftermath. I have you know, I've read a lot of those long opinions. I've spent probably years reading, and I don't think I've ever read a dissent perhaps quite as scathing as what your former colleague, Justice Stevens, said in that case. And I just want to read you one passage from there. He said, "One thing is certain, although we may never know with complete certainty the identity of the winner of this year's presidential election, the identity of the loser is perfectly clear. It is the nation's confidence in the judge as an impartial guardian of the rule of law," unquote. Do you think that the Bush versus Gore has left a mark on the court that's still a problem?
Well, that's something I'm not an expert on. I mean, I did dissent in that case. I was on the dissenting side, and there was, I mean, if you go, you go look at the Pew polls and so forth, and I think probably when I've looked at them, because I've been sort of interested, it shows a drop-off. I mean, normally the court's very much trusted. We're up really high up in the trust scheme, along with not quite up to the policemen, the firemen, the nurses, and the teachers, but that's okay. I mean, that's they're trusted as institutions. They should be. Oh, yeah, okay. And but then it recovers. It recovers. Our institutions recover in the public confidence to a considerable degree. And so from my point of view, it isn't quite that matters. I think what matters is it right or not. I mean, is this decision correct? I thought it was not correct, and I wrote my reasons down. We can't second-guess public opinion, really. And the thing that has made a mark on me in this case, too, is what I heard Senator Reid say, because I thought, my God, that's right. And this was sometimes later. Sometime later, he was talking at the court, because they have a dinner for new members of Congress there, the Senate puts on every couple of years. And he spoke, and he said that he thought that the most remarkable thing about the case of Bush versus Gore was something rarely remarked. And that was that even though half the country thought it was absolutely wrong and were really, really unhappy about it, there were no guns in the streets. There was no people throwing stones at each other. He said that's a plus for America, and that, in my opinion, is a plus. It is a big plus, and it suggests to me that over 200 years, that's a difference from Andrew Jackson, and let's send in the troops to do the opposite of what the court says. I think we have a pretty strong institution there, and I will. I understand there are a lot of people think, oh, well, it's too bad that they didn't really all go riot. Is it? I mean, is it? All you have to do is turn on the television set. You can see what happens in countries where that happens. And so I rather agree with what he said. We'll recover. I mean, it's a country has its ups and downs, but I have a lot of confidence. If you were there where I sit, you'd see that, and it's corny to say, but I feel it every day. Every race, every religion, every point of view, there are people, you know, who just, this is a very big country, and there are people who think all kinds of things very, very sincerely. And these very opposite things that they think in different backgrounds and different points of view, they've decided to come into the courtroom to solve some of their serious differences, as opposed to fighting it out in the streets. That is a treasure. That's what Harry Reid was saying. And that's what I see every single day. All right, now you have the emotional reason behind my trying to keep this going.
So, when you first worked at the court, you were a law clerk to Arthur Goldberg,
yes,
then a prominent labor lawyer, then Secretary of Labor before he went on the court. How did it feel to work at the court then as opposed to what it's like now? I mean, you were there. That was a very, I think by any measure, a very liberal court. I think it's not a very liberal court now. I mean, how does it feel to be there?
Well, first, I was a lot younger.
Right.
So everything felt great. But I think in looking back on it, it was a court with a mission. You see, in 1954, they decided Brown. And Congress didn't give them much help. in seeing that this was carried out. I mean, Eisenhower and the presidents did, and Jack Kennedy did, and the freedom, you know, they were, this was a big period of ferment, and the court was there, I think, first and foremost, thinking, looking back at it, that they wanted to be sure that this desegregation, the end of segregation, which they had said the law requires, was going to take place, at least as far as law was concerned. And that kept them pretty busy. And they all agreed about that. And the disagreements, so you can call it liberal, conservative, whatever you want. When people say liberal, conservative, etc., I say that's not my job. That can be your job. That's not my job. My job is to decide the cases in front of me. And at that time, there was that objective, and I think that that is not the major objective now. And it couldn't be. The country's different. That's something that, to some considerable degree, has been achieved, at least legally speaking. And so they're on to other things. Fine. But there I'll deal with the other things.
But don't you think that there have been, well, this is a, that there have been a lot of, I guess what I would call pot shots that are sort of errant that were taken at the Warren Court? It wasn't just Brown. I mean, they gave, you know, criminal defendants a right to have a lawyer. They changed the entire voting system in this country in a series of cases about one person, one vote that eliminated disproportionate representation. And that court even issued a decision that made it possible for one of your colleagues to be married to his current wife. Is there anything wrong with what the Warren Court did, do you think?
It's sort of interesting. I'm not thinking about, I don't know what decision.
Clarence Thomas. Loving versus Virginia.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. They're both very nice.
Yes.
Okay. I didn't put that together right away. Good. In trying, you know, I don't have an insight into that. I'm being historical, and you'll know more about it when I read what they do. I think maybe they're thinking, Brendan and the others, that, look, we've just taken this 14th Amendment, and it says no state shall deprive any person of equal protection of the law, and we've said it means what it says. And maybe we should do that in a few other areas. And those few other areas just hadn't been done before. It's caused a lot of fuss. But that is not the world of this court. It's very interesting, and it did a lot for America in many ways. But that is not the kinds of decisions I've had on either side, whoever or whatever you take. There are very few of those in front of us. We take cases.
Right, no, I understand.
We take cases that are on our agenda.
Right.
The cases that are on our agenda are, by and large, almost exclusively, cases where lower court judges have disagreed about the meaning of the same text, either in the Constitution or in a statute. There are a few others we'll take. We'll take a case if somebody holds something unconstitutional that Congress passed, and we might decide that the country needs a federal decision on some major matter like Guantanamo. But that's, it's more mechanical than people think. We get in 150 requests every week to hear a case. And we're looking through those to saying, is this a case where different judges have come to the same conclusion as a matter of federal law? And the answer is almost always no. And we hear about 80. And we're not sitting there trying not to take cases. It's the opposite. We're sitting there, we want to hear more cases. We think we could hear 100 anyway. So it's, but why have there not been these cases? I think there haven't been the cases because since that time, Congress has been passing fewer laws. I mean, Montaigne said that. Montaigne says a good comment because it shows you that things never change. 1584, he writes about some Roman emperor who thought it'd be a great idea to control his judges, to write a whole lot of statutes. He says, once they see all these statutes on everything, they won't be able to do what they want. They'll have to follow the statute. And Montaigne says, that man must have been a real fool. Doesn't he know that every statute has words and every word is a subject for a new argument by lawyers? He says, they'll give him more power, not less. All right, now go back and see how many laws Congress passed in the 60s, in the 70s. See what happened. We had NEPA. We had the environment. We had health and safety. We had the Civil Rights Acts. We had fair housing laws. We had one after another. So if you have 20 or 30 years where Congress is doing a lot less, it isn't surprising to me that the room for judges to disagree about the words that Congress enacted is less. At least that's my, that's a possible explanation. But we're off in a technical area, and I don't really see that this is too helpful. So I'll just stop here by saying it's not the same world. It's not the same court. There we are.
So you're going around doing a lot of educating of people about the court. You obviously think it's important for people to know more about the court. From my point of view, I think, regrettably, for a number of years, a number of your colleagues, I won't mention all of them, I think sort of stood in the way of people learning more about the court by taking a very arch stance against the televising of Supreme Court proceedings. In fact, I believe one of your former colleagues said Supreme Court hearings would be televised over his dead body. The Supreme Court is part of, the three parts of our government. Is there some reason why people shouldn't watch a Supreme Court argument on C-SPAN the same way people watch Congress?
Yep.
Well, please tell us.
As you know so well, and I know so well, the arguments for it, there are very strong arguments for it. It's important not to overlook the arguments for it. I mean, case I like to think about was this term limits case out of Arkansas. Which is, was it constitutional to limit the congressman to three terms or four terms? And is that consistent with certain language in the Constitution? It's a fabulous case for the reason it's so evenly balanced. You can look at what Jefferson and Story say one thing. Hamilton and Madison say the opposite. You have precedents over here. You have precedents on the opposite side. Everything looks as if it's balanced by something else. And if they could have seen that, the public, in the courtroom, in the oral argument, they would have seen nine judges really trying to figure something out. And they would have seen these issues are not so easy as you think when you read the paragraph written in a paper afterwards. So I would have loved to have had people seen that. But that is the opposite of what you told me. You want the opposite argument.
No, I want... I
know you don't
want
it,
I think they should all be.
You asked me.
No, I think they should all be televised.
You asked me why it's not obvious to do it. And I'm agreeing with you that there are very good reasons for doing it, but there are some reasons that are for not doing it. And you say what? And the kinds of things that concern people in reality are these. First, we are a major symbol of law in the United States. So if television were in there for the oral argument, I think it would be quite possibly in every criminal case in the country. And when you're talking about television being brought into criminal cases, we have experience with that here in California. And
I'm intimately familiar with that topic.
We also know witnesses sometimes worry about what their neighbors will think. And jurors sometimes worry that they might be identified and killed. And worse has happened. So I'd be pretty nervous about the criminal case, and I'd be pretty nervous if our entry turned out to be the symbol and it was everywhere. Second, people worry about this, that a wonderful thing about human beings is they identify with people they see. But the Supreme Court, in its oral argument, has a procedure that is about 2% of the procedure for deciding something. Almost everything is in writing. That oral argument is a tiny bit of what happens. But people watching it will say, oh, there's the good one, there's the bad one, the party here. But wait, our job is not, indeed less than any other court, these individuals in front of us. It is to think about how the rule that comes out of the case will affect 300 million people who aren't in front of us. And that's hard to get across visually. I can't say it's impossible, but it's somewhat easier to get across in print. And the third thing people worry about is the soundbite effect. And that, to give an example, which is a kind of joke example, but But sometimes people who are judges have been known to think that the press keeps two photos of you, one that makes you look great and the other makes you look like Attila the Hun. And when, in fact, they like what you did, they put in the great one. When they don't like it, they put in Attila the Hun. I'm not saying that really happens, but who knows? All right, but anyway, now, there are responses to these arguments I've given. Canada has television, and a lot of these bad things haven't happened. But we're trustees. We're not there for ourselves personally. We are trustees of an institution that has done a lot of good as well as some unfortunate things for this country. And a trustee is conservative by nature and should be. Because beware of mucking around with something that will produce changes you don't know too much about. Okay, now I've given you a picture. And I say, what's your solution, Breyer, to this picture? I have one and you will think it's awful. You will be asleep before I tell you what I think it is. But as a former teacher, I'm going to mention words that immediately turn everybody off. And the two words are like sociological study. There are people who do that. Pew Research. Pew finds out what public attitudes are. There is lots of experimentation going on here in the country. I would like to know what a few people who are serious professionals can find out by studying places where it's been done before, after, done in this way, not done in that way. It's called experiment, and it's called learn from experience. And it's called let's not have those studies paid for by the newspapers because maybe they have an interest. Let's have people who, objective, find out. And it's a slow process experiment. But eventually, I think maybe we'll be where you want, whether I'm here or not, because of the nature of the country. But I'd like informed decision making based on knowledge gathered from experience before I, as a trustee, have to cast a vote on that question.
Well, thanks. I just feel compelled to make one comment about that is that just as what the court does in oral argument is only a small percentage of what the court's work is that no one's suggesting having a camera come into your chambers to watch the deliberations. Although I must say, what people see on C-SPAN and the floor of Congress is maybe 2% of what they do, and we'd probably all be better off if we had the cameras in the cloakroom where the decisions are getting made. But with that, I think we're going to open it up for questions to the audience. People will be circulating with microphones. I think we have a gentleman right here. Oh, no, he's just taking a walk. Do we have a question? Yes, sir, down here.
Very interesting listening to you, sir.
Okay.
If you had been a practicing lawyer for an appreciable length of time, how do you think that would have informed or not informed or changed or altered how you think about the law and your experience on the Supreme Court?
Better. My brother was a practicing lawyer for a long time. He's now a judge. He was a member of the trial bar. And he's a federal district judge. And I say, you know, he lets me know where the cream of the profession lies, and I don't think he thinks it's in the appellate judiciary. So I said before he became a judge, I used to say, you know, I'd say we're God's children too. He'd say, there is no evidence. He's a little more hesitant about that since he became a judge. Anyway, yeah, experience is helpful there. I don't know because I didn't quite have it, and so I have to read into it. What that trial judge is thinking about and how he has to run his trial. And that's why I think really hierarchy, the word hierarchy in the judicial system is very misleading. I mean, it's a hierarchical system on paper, trial courts, appellate courts, Supreme Court. That's not what it is. It's a specialized system. And judges who are trial judges have a different job. And that's true of appellate court judges, and ours is different yet still. And so you have to understand that. You have to try to use a little bit of knowledge and see how far you can get. But it is important for us to understand, at the least, that the trial judge's job is a very different one.
Professor Weiner?
Oh. You said that the Warren Court was a court with a mission. Yes. Don't you think the Roberts Court is a court with a mission?
In the sense of the Warren Court? No.
Over here, we in the front.
I think three words have been resonating a lot in the media lately: Westboro Baptist Church. And I think that earlier today you were speaking about three things: the Constitution protects, the right to privacy, the right to free speech, and the right to practice free religion. And it seems like the situation that's going on right now before the Supreme Court, or that will be soon, really calls all of those three into an accounting, I would say, in that at some point we're going to have to decide whether one, I guess, overvalues the other or in some way is less valued. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on how you would expect or what you would consider in evaluating the idea of, I guess, the right to privacy in the funeral sense versus the right to free speech that these individuals in this church espouse.
The one thing I really can't do, which is so disappointing to you and probably lucky for me, is I can't really comment on cases that might come up or have come up. And the reason is a very good reason. The reason is, and this is from my experience, there's a strong rule of ethics against that. But the reason is that when we have a case like the one you're talking about or any other case, what happens, we've selected it out of maybe 150 because it's a very big deal issue, and at least, you know, there was just a disagreement among the judges. I mean, it could be a minor issue. It could be. We had a case, does the comma after a certain number in the Internal Revenue Code mean the next word, which is a 4, should be read as a which or a that? Why did we take that case? Because it was a split. One thought one thing, one thought the other. You know, I thought it was sort of an interesting case. Nobody else did. Anyway, you see, now, why not comment? Because I've learned over time that when people actually have a case in the court, they begin to brief it. And we get this blue brief from the petitioner, and the red one from the respondent, and the yellow one, which is reply, and gray from the government. The government's always gray. And then we'll have these groups or individuals who are supporting the petitioner, light green, and the other side, dark green. And in the affirmative action case, we had 100. And in the right to die, right to assisted suicide, we had 80. Now, we read them all. We couldn't do it if you had that in every case. A typical case is 10 or 15. And lo and behold, but we have 80, you can read 80, and they begin to be repetitive. You can catch that, and it takes less time when it's being repetitive. But by interesting enough, the first, that Grutter case, Michigan, the affirmative action case, they weren't very repetitive. Amazing. So we become pretty well informed about it. People try to inform us. And I have learned over time, it isn't just hot air. Sometimes what I might say at a cocktail party is very different from what I will say when the decision becomes real. And so this ethical rule is there to protect me from myself. Don't sound off about opinions on things that might really come before you. Decide them on the basis of those arguments and evidence that's there in front of you, and that makes a difference.
Over here, gentleman in the red shirt.
First of all, Justice Breyer, to thank you for being here. I think all of us enjoy listening to you. I just like to know, as far as like, what sort of sound advice can you give to someone who's looking to pursue a possible career in law?
It's a great field, actually, and people don't understand that it is. I mean, why? Because I've always thought it's so lucky if you're doing that, because you have to have a fairly good mind to get into it, and you have to be interested in reason and logic and thought, and you also have to have a heart. And so it combines head and heart. And you won't always know that in all your cases. God, I'm just trying to think. Somebody had a case, his friend of mine says, what was that first case he had? He had the first case, I think it was two neighbors, and one had a dog that bit the other one's dog. And he said, why am I involved in this? But there we are. I can't say it always applies. But nonetheless, by and large, it's a career where you both have an opportunity to use both of these aspects of human life, head and heart. And boy, you can't just be heart, but you can't just be head. And also, over time, it gives you a chance to get involved in some civic affairs sometimes. And you can reach out to the community. And I don't want to sound as if I'm giving a lecture, but God, I have so many friends who went into law and became important in their firm, and they say one of the worst days was when we decided that we were just going to try to make as much money as we could. They weren't happy about it. I got good advice from Dick Guggenheim when I started with a law firm over the summer in San Francisco years ago. He said, you're not going to get rich, but you will do well. Depending, you know, I may not do well. but he said, if you want to be rich, go into business. He said, that's the place to go. Because you are getting money from people for whom you do something. You do something for them. You give them something. And they give you money in return. Nothing wrong with that. But as a lawyer, you are what's called a fiduciary. You are what's called an agent. You are working in someone else's interest. You're a trustee. You're helping them. And like a doctor, they'll pay you for helping them. But the main thing is the help you give them, and they in return will pay you. The main thing is not necessarily a huge bottom line. Now, how can I say that? I know nothing about money. Every investment I have tends to fail, and so I'm one of the least expert people to talk about this, as my friends usually know. But nonetheless, you triggered it, so there you are.
Lady in the back here, yes.
When the Constitution was written, the only people who could vote and the assumed population was landed white men. And so the Constitution in its writing, we have this beautiful foundation document that in no way assumes a population with as many interests as we now have or a population as heterogeneous as it is now. So while the Supreme Court is sort of left to pick up the slack and make the Constitution relevant in every way, its composition also isn't as representative as sort of life on the ground in daily America. What does that look like for you in terms of the perception, your perception of how justice is created or how law is created representative of American life on the ground?
The Constitution has grown over time. No, hasn't it? Women vote. African Americans vote. Everyone over 18 votes. Right? Okay. It's grown over time. It's tried to be more representative. And as far as the membership of the court is concerned, that is not something I can control. The membership of the court is quite different than what it was when I was a law clerk in terms of diversity. And in general, diversity is a plus. I find every day that people having different experience is a plus. And so there we are. I can't say much more than that. I remember when you talk about appointments, I always say I've used this joke about 500 times because it has a point, but my wife told me if I say it once more, she's walking out. But I said, I didn't appoint anyone. The appointment process and the nominating process is a political process. After you're appointed, you have robes on. And then you're not political. But before, it's the political process you go through. It's the president and the senators. And I had to do that. I had to sit in front of 17 senators at the table. And I knew what they were going to ask me. They were going to ask me what they thought their constituents wanted asked. And beyond that, I had no idea. And the place to influence what they ask is with their constituents. It is the public, it is the democratic process that will decide how that confirmation process runs, not the people who are appointed. And it's okay. You know, I thought I was confirmed, you know, I thought I liked it. But give you a little picture of that. I think what I should, you see, I knew everybody's listening on radio, television. millions of people, and luckily I was very boring, they turned it off. But if they don't like you, you won't be confirmed. I have confidence, some. People are pretty tolerant in this country, even about people they disagree with. When are you reasonably fair? Do you seem okay? And they'll respect that. But if it had been no, it would have been no. And the reason is this document puts a little democratic window in a process that's going to select a person to go to an institution where democracy now no longer can control that person for good reason, as we've gone into. All right? So that's why I say, you ask me questions about the makeup of the court, or you ask me questions about who's going to be appointed and so forth, I say it's like asking for the recipe for chicken a la king from the point of view of the chicken.
Yes. Lady back here.
Hi, thank you for coming to Los Angeles. I'm curious to know how you would extend the argument about legitimacy of judicial rulings to state Supreme Courts, particularly those that elect their justices. I'm thinking in particular about the case in West Virginia where you had a mining company owner, I believe it was, who contributed a large amount of money to the campaign of particular justice who sure enough ended up ruling in favor of a case that the mining company had before the court a few months later. And then more recently in California, it turns out the Supreme Court here might have the last word on Prop 8 because of the questions about who has standing to sue. And I know you can't comment on what you think about that case, but just in terms of legitimacy of electing state Supreme Court justices, if you have an opinion on how that impacts the legitimacy of the rulings.
Well, I have talked about this to a degree with Sandra O'Connor and with Tony Kennedy and David Souter. I mean, some of the judges have discussed this publicly. And what we've tended to say, and what I think is, and I know what Sandra O'Connor thinks, is that this is a problem, and in particular with campaign finance. And the way to easily, the most easy way to think about the problem is a person who is a criminal defendant, who might be incredibly unpopular, has the same rights as everyone else, and they're important criminal defendant rights. And now, would you like, if you were somehow put in that position, to be judged by a person who will lose his job if he decides in your favor? No. And that is a problem. And it becomes more of a problem if you have, say, the trial bar, or you have the insurance companies, or you have someone else contributing millions of dollars to that person's campaign chest. And in the case you mentioned, we said this has gone too far, for the due process clause, which forbids depriving a person of his liberty without due process of law, because a company that was involved in the case had given quite a few millions of dollars directly or indirectly to the judge who was deciding it and said, no, that goes too far. All right, well, the solutions to these things are not so easy. There are, because the notion of electing judges is very popular in many states. And we can say what we like, but a judge is a person who has a considerable amount of authority in the case in front of him. I learned a long time ago, when a judge starts talking about things that are not right within his or her peer view, the lawyers nod politely, and they smile, and they go out and say to each other, there he is, sounding off again. Okay? So they're complicated, the solutions. And there are many different ways of melding elective systems with non-elective systems. The Missouri plan is one that's often mentioned. And California's system is often mentioned as favorably because it's not directly elective. It's a confirming process, or at least it used to be when I lived here. And there are many, many different ways. And so your question suggests to me that it's a very good idea for bar associations and others to become interested in this problem and to work with groups so they can be certain or more certain that that problem will not be too terrible. You know, we had South Dakota, which had on the amendments, it's hard to be against elected judges once you start, or it's hard to be against campaign contributions. In South Dakota, they had something on the ballot which said jail for judges. You know, it sounded great, even, you know, it sounds good. But They were going to set up a system where you could select 12 people at random, and then those 12 people would decide if the judge was really seriously wrong. And if he was really seriously wrong, you'd send him to jail, or you'd have a lot of money. Now, that was winning. That was winning in the polls. And then, which you could understand that, but it doesn't sound like a great idea. But and then some civic-minded people got together and they raised some money and they went around retail and discussed with people the harms that might flow from that, and it lost. All right, but those who like that kind of thing are not necessarily going to stop. So good. Glad you asked the question.
We can take one more. This gentleman's had his hand up for a while. If we could bring the mic down here.
If my information is correct, on May 3rd this year, the court voted 7-2 to close the front door against the public, denying us access up those 44 marble steps, equal justice under law, inspiring to enter that way. The dissenters, of course, were you and Justice Ginsburg. Now, as one of the dissenters, can you explain to me, is it the case that the other seven justices were governed by a fear that you and Justice Ginsburg are immune to?
I make one minor qualification. You don't know, though I do know, how many people voted for it. You know there were at least five. And you know that two disagreed strongly enough that they wrote something publicly. And this is, I wrote something because I thought it was a terrible idea. I was so sorry about it. But it's part of our time, you see, that people get very, very worried about security. I can understand that. I was involved in Boston when I was a chief judge there in building a new courthouse. And we got the money, and we got some pretty good architects. You've seen this right here. You see it with the Disney Center. You see it with a lot of public buildings. It's such a wonderful thing for everybody, for people who never think about architecture. It's such a wonderful thing when you get a building put up that says something to the community. This is an attractive place. It's your building. Come on into this library. Look at the murals. Look at how we've organized this patio. Look at this concert center. Come and see it. It's yours. Be there. That is so uplifting. And the same with courthouses. And I'd been involved in that. And we have what I call the Ellsworth Kelly Museum. But nonetheless, it's an attractive courthouse, and it brings people in. School children can go and learn something about being judges, and the bar likes it. And they'll bring in, have moot courts and so forth. So I became sort of an advocate of this. And I felt pretty strongly. And when I go around and look at Washington, D.C., and see that it's filled with these green hitching posts, which I think must come out of a John Wayne Martian movie, I get a little depressed. And so that's why I wrote this. I said, I understand reasonable people can differ about this. I understand it. But I think the only way we're going to have embassies that don't look like, you ever seen the one in Chile? It looks like, to me, I don't want to be too rude, but I mean, it looks like Fort Knox on stilts. And why? It doesn't have to, in my view and experience, even with security needs. And so how do you stop that? My experience tells me that somebody, look, you ask the security people, it's their job to think of security. What do you think they're going to say? It's their job. They're supposed to think of all the security risks. And they don't mind if somebody who's in authority here, who's an elected official or a higher official, takes the time necessary to understand that security person's point of view, to understand that study, and to try to figure out if there's a way that you can meld good architecture and their concern. Now, my own experience tells me that's possible. And I don't want to, you know, have a diatribe here. But obviously, I felt that wasn't possible in the case of where we're closing the steps, because I thought it was a great symbol of great importance to justice and to the court that people can walk up those steps and walk into that courtroom. They can still walk down the steps. and they'll have a nice way in around the side. But I thought that's a different thing. So that's why Ruth and I wrote our dissent.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujakji Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and public television station KCET. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.